Environmental work, EPA worker, part of Laura Nix's remarkable series, I do solemnly swear. One of the Veteran Health Administration, VA employee, warned that suicide prevention lines for veterans are understaffed and overwhelmed, raising alarm for life or death consequences. I think that population, veterans, is one of the largest suicide rates. Can you talk about that?
Yeah, I was really struck by the VHA worker that I spoke to. They're incredibly dedicated to their veteran clients, and they spoke very emotionally about how worried they are about their welfare in the future. And, you know, the series is directed, my co-creator Mark Weiss and I felt it was very important to focus on not just the illegality of the firings, but the impact on Americans of the hollowing out of these services and benefits. And we've depended for a very long time thinking that these benefits and these the safety of our highways, our water, our airspace is safe. But we're learning that these are all being taken away. In the instance of VHA,
we have 10 seconds.
Okay, this is a population that needs help, and they're very dedicated. These public servants are dedicated and committed to providing services.
We have to leave it there. I think 18 veterans die by suicide each day. That does it for our show. I'm Amy Goodman. Thanks for joining us.
You're listening to KBOO Portland.
KBOO Community Radio holds open meetings concerning the operations and programming of KBOO in accordance with requirements of the Communications Act of 1934 and certification requirements of the Corporation for Public Broadcasting. Information about KBOO Community Radio's open meeting policy is available at our website at kboo.fm. The Development and Events Committee meets on the third Monday of the month at 5:30 p.m. This month's meeting will be held online through a public video conference. A public link and phone number to attend the meeting can be found on our website at kboo.fm. Please visit our website to verify if a meeting is being held.
The commonly understood definition of imperialism is one great nation exerting its power over smaller nations. Well, it can happen domestically as well. That's something really new under the Trump administration. As we'll see from today's discussion, I'm Bert Cohen, and with your help, we are keeping democracy alive.
He's not breathing.
Can you get a pulse?
Barely.
Imperialism. For most of us, if we even think of that word, we think of old empires like the formerly Great Britain. But the sun finally did set on the British Empire. Since our founding, the nature of the United States has been that we were free from imperial rule, that we were different. Many politicians today still cling to the notion of American exceptionalism, though again, most of us would say that the U.S. has never had imperial ambitions, that in terms of foreign policy, we were different. Our goals have always been siding with the oppressed of the world. To remind us of the confinement in which our guest finds himself, you will hear on this podcast interruptions by the authorities, but we'll keep on going right through them. Thank you. In fact, I was taught in elementary school.
This call is from the North Carolina Correctional Facility.
All right, you still there?
Yeah, I'm still here.
Oh, that's weird. Though, again, most of us would say the U.S. has never had imperial ambitions, that in terms of foreign policy, we were different. Our goals have always been siding with the oppressed of the world and offering them freedom. I was taught in elementary school that the United States brought freedom and democracy to oppressed people so that individuals could have control over their own lives and not be under the thumb of an imperialist repressive government. All that changed with the manipulation of the Monroe Doctrine of 1823, by which U.S. foreign policy was established to oppose European colonialism in the Americas. But since at least the first Gilded Age in the 1890s, when the de facto political power of the U.S. was first located in the hands of a few ultra-wealthy interests, sound familiar, the imperialistic, intentionally imperialistic, invisible reality has been that we are indeed most imperialistic. In the so-called Spanish-American War of 1898, we projected an image of freeing people in Cuba and the Philippines from the claws of the Spanish Empire. But we, in fact, imposed a new, rather harsh imperialism of our own, which was remarkably oppressive and actually more brutal than we want to see or admit. Then there was Vietnam, which thought they had broken the chains of French imperialism in 1954 and in fact looked to the United States to deliver freedom and democracy, but instead became the new imperial power over them. And today there remains not only a domestic version of imperialism through mass incarceration, but under the second Trump administration, there's new, much more vigorous embrace of what our guest today calls carceral imperialism. I had never heard of that before. The unbridled glee exhibited by the Orange One at the prospect of a new, massive expansion of our prison system is but one part of his empowering of Project 2025, which he dishonestly claimed to know nothing about. Imagine Trump being dishonest. Huh, who would have thought? What we mean here is exemplified by his excited talk of reopening Alcatraz as a new prison for the expected huge expansion of detainees, victims of imperialism, most of them being unfortunate immigrants swept up by the new Gestapo called ICE. In recent days, local residents in the Florida Everglades region have come out in angry protest of the proposed so-called alligator Alcatraz. The not-so-hidden motivation behind this carceral imperialism is a complete transformation of our republic into an oligarchy with a few of the few hyper-wealthy white men. We all know our prison population is majority people of color, and of course Trump intends to incarcerate many thousands of undocumented immigrants who are largely people of color. A militarized domestic empire. And that's something new. That's what we're going to talk about. Our guest on today's Keeping Democracy is Lyle May. He's written a provocative essay which will be the focus of our discussion. The essay is titled Carceral Imperialism, Project 2025, and the Enemy of Progress. It was published by Portside and Prism. Lyle C. May is an Ohio University alum, member of the Alpha Sigma Lambda Honor Society, an incarcerated journalist and author of the books Witness, an Insider's Narrative of the Carceral State, which came out in 2024, and The Transformative Journey of Higher Education in Prison, A Class of One. Well, thank you so much for being with us, Lyle. Appreciate that. It was a little hard to get through because I can't call you. You have to call me because you are, in fact, a prisoner. But We won't get into that too far. But as you will show with the second election of Donald Trump, draconian approaches to crime and punishment, our guest calls a new form that borrows from and implements old ideas of totalitarian and fascistic governments. Our guest says, whether in the past or present, imperialism that is reframed in patriotic language does not make it less brutal to those who lose their land, liberty, and lives, or have their identities folded into American conquest. This is now happening domestically, and it's something new. Well, I'll tell you, Lyle, over 20 years, 20-plus years I've been producing Keeping Democracy Alive, we've had guests from nations around the world, but this is a first. You know, Lyle May, about today's topic from firsthand experience. Thanks for being with us today. I really appreciate it. Tell us, please, where are you currently located?
Thank you for inviting me to speak today. I'm currently located in Raleigh, North Carolina. I am incarcerated on death row, in fact. I have been here since 1999 when I was sentenced to death as a 21-year-old. I've been incarcerated since 1997. So for the past 28 years, I have grown up in prison. And it has been both a harrowing experience, but also a very educational one, because I choose it to be that way. I choose to learn not just about my environment, but about the system that I'm in. And what I've discovered is, as you stated, that I am in
this call is from a North Carolina correctional facility,
a carceral empire that now is expanding under the second Trump administration. But I believe was certainly the foundation was laid long ago Certainly, it began with the fomenting of mass incarceration under the Omnibus Crime Bill of 1994, and even prior to that. But we can say today, with all sincerity and without any exaggeration whatsoever, that it is exponentially worse. Worse in the ways that it is melding with immigration and deportation, worse in the ways that it is actively seeking to build prisons in other countries to house deported migrants, but also U.S. citizens, as we've seen with Diego Garcia and others. And that is really the scariest thing in all of this, especially with the most recent information coming out about the denaturalization process that the Trump administration is seeking, you know, to first, of course, target its political enemies, such as Zoran Mondani in New York, with the, and then, of course, you better believe that they'll go on to target potentially senators and congressmen who were not, who stand to be in danger of being those political targets. And, you know, you might think that because you were born in the U.S., that makes you safe. Yeah. But as we've seen with the U.S. Supreme Court, they recently said that birthright citizenship is in fact in a state of flux. So
yes,
that further erodes what protections that, you know, U.S. citizens believe they have from these kinds of government overreach. And it goes so far beyond ordinary government overreach to, you know, really, it's not even just about erosion of democracy anymore. It's about the end of democracy, certainly in this country. And I think the frightening thing for those of you out there is that you don't really have any experience with being subjugated and oppressed and executed, whereas those of us who are on the inside, that is, you know, that is the air we breathe. And that's something that we have to really get all of you on the outside to understand. It's like this system was created with the original intent of punishing actual crimes. Now you have somebody in power who is essentially consolidating that power to borrow from that system and expand it in a way that has never been done in this country and was certainly never intended by the founders of this country or the Constitution.
The founders of this country certainly never imagined carceral imperialism, that we would have imperialism functioning at home against people who may be seen as undocumented immigrants. And you talk about, you know, people not being safe, you know, in this constant fire hose of formerly unthinkable news from America's executive branch. There are so many shocking incidents, it's easy to lose focus. For example, one of the things you mentioned, can a politician be taken down? A United States Senator from California, Alex Padilla, was forcibly ejected and handcuffed, forced to lie down on the floor and handcuffed when he tried to ask a question of the head of Homeland Security, Kristi Noem. Trump later said of this that the senator, quote, looked like an illegal. Looked like an illegal. How does this instance exemplify part of what's in the MAGA platform, do you think, Lyle?
Well, and that's, as you say, it very much the MAGA platform, or better yet, what is the Heritage Foundation and other think tanks that are supporting that MAGA platform, and that is Project 2025.
Yes.
And I firmly believe that this is ultimately what enabled Project 2025 to happen, that it was so shocking, that it was so disbelievable to the average American that they would never even consider that such a thing would happen. And now that it is happening, even the reporting on it has been really kind of soft, in the sense that there's still that kind of sense of disbelief. And it's like, oh, well, we don't really believe that this is happening. This is unimaginable.
Right.
Rather than saying, okay, well, now that it is happening, here's where it could potentially lead to, or here's where it is actually going. When Trump first opened up the idea of revamping and opening up Alcatraz, the original Alcatraz, mm-hmm. it probably should have come into mind that, okay, well, somebody's going to borrow on this idea and expand on it. And sure enough, yeah. Ron DeSantis and the private prison prosecutors of the GEO Corps have indeed created a 5,000-bed facility in the Florida Everglades called Alligator Alcatraz. And
you have 60 seconds remaining.
On the one hand, it seems just, again, to lend that disbelief that you would even label something Alligator Alcatraz, but that's the disarming nature of the diabolicism behind Project 2025, that it's so unbelievable that surely it would never happen, and by the time that you're having that thought, it's already happened. And that is the problem, that nobody is actually getting ahead of these attacks on our democracy and Constitution.
The title of your essay is Carceral Imperialism, Project 2025, and the Enemy of Progress. It blends a few seemingly distinct observations. Say, Carceral Imperialism, Project 2025, and the Enemy of Progress. It's a few seemingly distinct parts. What ties them together?
First and foremost, I think it's important to remember how the criminalization process works. It begins through fear-mongering. We see this in the sense of what was done in the lead-up, not just to this election, but in prior elections around the whole immigration issue. Is almost immediately, the people who were coming into the United States were labeled lawbreakers. They were labeled terrorists. They were labeled gang members, anything that could be possibly attached to them to justify what would ultimately be done to them. And this criminalization process occurred in the 90s with the Omnibus Crime Bill, when we had the whole issue with super predators. It happened in the 60s with the Civil Rights Movement, and it happens almost certainly with the way the Nazis the Jews in World War II and the Holocaust. They were these people who had committed no crimes other than wanting to exist in peace,
right?
Were labeled lawbreakers. And in so doing, the fear was able to be attached to the idea that these people would come into.
This call is from a North Carolina correctional facility.
They would take your things, they would take your ability to get a job, they would usurp your position, your quote-unquote rightful position as Americans in a country where you have earned it by right.
By right.
And by feeding into that fear, by fanning that particular flame, the GOP, MAGA, the Heritage Foundation, the people who created Project 2025, were able to pull the wool over American people's eyes in order to kind of justify and get away with many of the things that they're doing, many of the laws that they're breaking. Because many Americans, I'm sad to say, are very selfish in the way that they view resources. They're not very willing to open their arms to the poor neighbor. And we see this most especially amongst the marginalized. We see this certainly in prison. And I'm not saying that people who are convicted of actual crimes shouldn't be punished. But what I am saying is that by feeding into this idea of punishment, by feeding into the criminalization of ordinary people,
right,
it expands your access. It expands your ability as a government to attack and to blur the lines between what is actual justice and what is actually criminal. And that is where we see such suggestions like suspending the federal habeas and denaturalization and all of these other ideas that are just unthinkable to people who actually know the law, who know what the Constitution protects. When we see this erosion when we see this erosion of these ideas, pretty much anything goes, and that's what ties it together. It's not so much a tying, so to speak, of Project 2025. It's Project 2025 has muddied the water so much that it makes the average person unable to tell what's up and what's down. There's so much misinformation out there,
intentionally,
so much disinformation out there, intentional disinformation. It was never the Russians. It was never the Chinese. It was never the Iranians. It was always the people who created Project 2025. That was their intent. That was their goal. And now that they've been able to do that, now that they're folding government oversight committees, now that they're folding whole agencies and closing agencies and consolidating power, they've enabled this, they've just enabled all of this ability to expand the carceral state. So it's no longer just a state, it's an empire. It is an empire that goes into El Salvador. It is an empire that transports prisoners in the way that they haven't done in centuries to other countries to be imprisoned and, you know, to potentially be subjected to worse fates than might happen in an American prison.
Oh, really? And this is, some of this is not new. We have a history. There are ugly things in our history that the Trump administration wants us not to learn, such as a history of finding the other, othering people. And now, you know, in the past, it was during the First World War, it was any German-American or hyphenated American. And in the 50s, there was, of course, you know, treating the other people who were at all left-leaning as people to be conquered, as the enemy. Our guest today is Lyle May, and he's written a very interesting and provocative, frightening essay called Carceral Imperialism, Project 2025, and the Enemy of Progress. We've all heard of Stephen Miller, who looks like a gargoyle, who is promoting the use of Gestapo-like tactics on immigrants, as we have seen more and more. You say one of the key players in the worsening problem of mass incarceration is someone I never heard of, Gene Hamilton. Who is Gene Hamilton?
Gene Hamilton is one of the primary authors of Project 2025 and central to the ability of the current Trump administration to carry out many of the diabolical policies that it has been enacting. You better believe that Donald Trump did not suddenly come up the top of his head with all of these executive orders he's been signing. These were handed to him on the day that he got into office by people like Gene Hamilton, who knew what they wanted, who knew from the beginning, before Trump even made it into office, who said to him, hey, if you get into office on day one,
this call is from a North Carolina correctional facility.
Here's what you can do. It's not about democracy at that point. It's about consolidating and holding and maintaining power. So I think in all of this, in talking about Project 2025 and carceral imperialism, in getting the average American to really understand what this means for them, is when you talk about things such as, for example, suspending the federal habeas, first person that we heard talk about this was Stephen Miller, but it wasn't just Stephen Miller's idea. This is an idea that came right out of Project 2025. And when you talk about suspending the federal habeas, you're talking about the government's requirement to tell the judiciary why it's holding you in confinement and answering to that judiciary. And as we've seen in the erosion of the judiciary's authority in the kind of the bogging down of that judiciary with numerous frivolous lawsuits by the administration to force them to get into this process, what happens is that when you talk about suspending a federal habeas for the average citizen who gets in confinement and, you know, the government is required to go through the process of, okay, we have Joe Brown who's incarcerated because we've charged them with this particular crime and here is our evidence. And what's going to happen if that federal habeas gets suspended is the government says, well, we don't have to tell you anything. We just think he's a criminal. We're going to hold him just because. And while that might seem far-fetched on its surface, and we can talk about, oh, well, it would have to be approved by Congress, we already know what Congress is about in terms of rubber stamping agendas for the administration. We already know that there are workarounds like the denaturalization process that makes federal habeas even more difficult to reach. You know, getting back to that denaturalization of U.S. citizens, we knew from the way that people in Guantanamo were treated that once you were labeled an enemy combatant, the gloves were off and the toolkit was open. They could do everything to you and pretty much anything that they wanted. And they did that to a number of people who were charged with quote-unquote terrorism, even though the majority of those people were ultimately released. Now, imagine when all of these potential implements are now available to enact against the average American who doesn't do anything wrong, who doesn't commit a crime, who votes however he or she wants to, but maybe they're not white.
Maybe
they're not unnatural, or they weren't always in that white Christian majority, or they're aligned with those particular kinds of people. And then you know, it gets very scary very quickly. And I don't say this and talk about carceral imperialism as a way of fear-mongering, but a way of illustrating and explaining exactly what is going on in such a way that current outlets just really aren't talking about.
Well, history has shown all too clearly, following up on that, the manipulation of fear is a uniquely powerful political tool. Please tell us about how Project 2025's political agenda is, as you say, feeding, quote, crime myths, which begin by condemning others, playing into prejudices toward a class of people, then building esteem through policy comparisons, end of quote. How does that show itself? And please explain why you say this is the bedrock of carceral imperialism. What do you mean, Lyle?
So it's important to remember where this idea of crime myths come from. You know, we could talk about the really classic literature example of Frankenstein and the group of villagers who have their pitchforks and torches and they're running the monster into a corner so they can corral the problem and put it to death. But what they ultimately end up finding out is that the real monsters are the people holding the pitchforks, are the people holding the torches who fail to really question and think critically about what it is that they're doing. And by failing in that critical thinking, that is where the people of Project 2025 step in and assert their policies.
Wow.
They feed into that crime myth, the fear, the idea that you absolutely have to punish people who commit crimes, and then they attach it to the prejudices of those same people who maybe they feel a certain kind of way about Spanish-speaking people, or maybe they feel a certain kind of way about Black people or brown people or indigenous people or gays and lesbians or any of those who are already marginalized,
right,
because they don't fit a particular majority category. The whole impetus.
You have 60 seconds remaining.
And removal of DEI programs is a prime example of that, of these wedge issues that were used to leverage those hatreds and prejudices and tax criminality to those kind of behaviors, even though they've never been criminal. They've never been anything particularly wrong, other than it wasn't like that person. It is that whole otherism process.
Otherism, yes. As you point out, no undocumented immigrants are safe from deportation. And you note that American otherism of immigrants is not new, as we discussed briefly, and neither is the intersection of immigration and the criminal legal system, nor the false morality of Christian nationalists who pursue cruel exclusionary policies under the guise of public safety. American history is threaded with such efforts, as you say. There is no lack of examples. Please, Lyle, tell us about some which may not be readily thought of. For one example, you write about something I'd not heard of that President Eisenhower did. Do tell, please.
Yes. So in the mid-50s, President Dwight D. Eisenhower launched the largest mass deportation operation in American history. And it was named for a racist slur called Operation Wetback.
Mm-hmm.
And essentially what occurred is that Border Patrol was militarized in a way that had never happened before. And they rounded up a number of Mexican immigrants and Mexican-American citizens, American citizens, who, without any form of due process or notification to their families, they were shoved into trucks and on ships,
wow,
dumped into unfamiliar towns across the border.
This call is from a North Carolina correctional facility.
They suffered, and many of which actually died. It was only much later that it was discovered exactly how many this was done to.
Mm.
And while the government had claimed it was slightly over 1 million people who were deported during the operation, you know, more misinformation, historians actually believe the number is closer to a little over 250,000, right around 300,000. And this particular example is important because Trump referenced it. He's well aware of that history and is comfortable relying on it as a foundational point for his own operation,
right,
because mm-hmm. Trump's always been about, you know, being number one and being the best, and he wants to beat that number. And referenced this particular operation in one of his many stump speeches. So when you talk about problematic types of policy,
yeah,
you don't copy it. You avoid copying it. Maybe you find a better way, but
you would think.
Obviously that's not the case here.
No. I had not heard of the criminal alien program before I read your essay. What the heck is that, the criminal alien program?
So the criminal alien program, before there was such a thing as ICE, was launched shortly after the Illegal Immigration Reform and Immigrant Responsibility Act that was passed in the mid-90s. Everybody likes to talk about the 1994 Omnibus Crime Bill, which, you know, related very much to the Anti-Terrorism and Effective Death Penalty Act and the Prison Litigation Reform Act. But then there was this Illegal Immigration Reform and Immigrant Responsibility Act, which effectively criminalized crossing the border without knowledge of the Border Patrol. It was then in 1996 that it was really first made a crime to enter the country without knowledge. So that's how new this criminalization process is with regard to crossing the border. The criminalization process is not new, just how it's being attached to migrants. And in terms of the criminal alien program, this is what created ICE. Or you can say that one created the other. You know, it's a kind of a chicken egg question. Mm-hmm. But it empowered ICE to carry out these wide-scale immigration enforcement operations like you're seeing now. This is where it came from. Admittedly, in the 90s and early 2000s, when ICE actually did seem like it was a reasonable idea, maybe, and I hesitate to say that because, you know, it's criminalizing anybody for crossing a particular property line just seems ridiculous.
But yeah, without them doing anything illegal, yeah.
Yeah, when you're talking about going into churches and schools and ballparks to arrest and forcibly detain people that you suspect may be a migrant who crossed a line without the knowledge of the Border Patrol, and these people, ICE, are, you know, fully militarized now, wearing masks and helmets and riot gear in order to do this, you really have to question if it was ever about law and order and really more about the forcible erasure of black and brown people from American society.
Yes, he's clearly interested in that. And we've seen such an idea before take hold of a leader that history has not treated well appropriately. If you just tuned in, Bert Cohen here. The show is Keeping Democracy Alive. Our guest today is Lyle May, who's written an essay titled Carceral Imperialism Project 2025 and the Enemy of Progress. The remarkably inhumane conditions of the prisons in El Salvador, where we've sent lots of people who are accused of being gang members, without any kind of due process whatsoever. They've been designated foreign terrorist organizations. But the inhumane conditions are bolstered, I would think, by the fact that the Trump regime, as you point out, is paying an annual fee to that government for their incarceration of our prisoners. Is this an example of what you cite as carceral imperialism?
Yes. So in business, if we were seeing what was going on, you would call this outsourcing the labor to another country because it's cheaper or the materials are easier to put in this one particular location.
This call is from a North Carolina correctional facility.
Generally speaking, though, when you talk about outsourcing, it's all about the cheap labor and the ability to circumvent particular laws and restrictions on that labor. But when you're talking about the confinement of human beings, it's absolutely something much different and much more diabolical. It's still very much about circumventing constitutional law. It's still very much about avoiding detection of crimes that are being committed against other human beings. It's still about putting people out of sight and out of mind. And removing them in such a way that is abhorrent to constitutional principles, that doing so to the degree and extent that the current administration is criminal.
What about the notorious private for-profit prisons in the United States? I was very pleased when President Biden, who I think history will treat well, when he ended Department of Justice contracts with such entities, private for-profit prisons. But then Trump rescinded that. Please tell us about the GEO group and their role in carceral imperialism.
So the GEO group is one of the world's largest private prison companies. And I think it's important to remember that when we talk about private prisons, it's not just the actual brick-and-mortar prison.
Right.
We're talking about electronic monitoring. We're talking about telecommunications. We're talking about health care. We're talking about all the different resources and requirements that American prisons allow within their system. Well, the GEO group further profits in their creation of cheaply made detention facilities like that of Alligator Alcatraz. Now, I don't know necessarily if Alligator Alcatraz, and I apologize for having to refer to it like that, if that facility was in fact built by the GEO group, but there will be many more facilities like that built in Texas. Texas is actually seeking to create 100,000 bed facilities, facilities with 100,000 beds, and there will be other states that follow suit. But apparently right now it seems to be these really deep red states that have absolutely no trouble and no conscience, no morale, moral compass that points away from this idea of mass incarceration of migrants in these detention facilities. Well, the GEO group profits from that lack of morality, profits from that desire to confine and inflict this form of punishment on people who are just seeking a better life. And moreover, the GEO group, when you really break it down, has a number of people on its board, one of whom is Tom Homan, the current leader of this immigration, the deportation measures.
Yeah, clampdown.
So never think that in all of this, there's not some capitalistic angle embedded in it. It's absolutely about money at the end of the day, but it's also very much about power. And the money angle for the GEO group is, oh, well, here's an administration who doesn't care about human rights, so we'll be able to not only make up the ground we lost under the Biden administration, but gain much of it back and then some. And then what you have is an administration willing to remove checks and balances that funnel people into these private prisons and fill them and require more private prisons and more money and so on and so on and so forth. And then it just expands from there.
You talk about the profit motive playing into this inhumane system. What about other various enterprises and hedge funds are, as you say, quote, willing to profit from human suffering to build more prisons? These hedge funds that nobody knows exactly what they do, I mean, maybe they do, but I don't. How does that work? How are they profiting from more human suffering?
Well, a good way to look at a hedge fund is to look at it as like a PAC, a political action committee. They're the dark money behind groups like the GEO group or Core Civic. They're the people who are on Wall Street, who are investing in private prison stock, which soared as soon as Trump was elected. They are the attorneys. They are the judges. They are the stock analysts. They are all of the white collar people who behind the scenes seem to be ordinary law abiding citizens in the United States who are simply turning a profit, but they're turning a profit on human suffering. They're turning a profit removed from the front line of things. They're never seen as the actual people driving the front line.
Right.
The war effort absolutely has to be resourced. And those resources come from those hedge funds. Those hedge funds drive the GEO group, drive Core Civic, drive mass incarceration and Alligator Alcatraz and CCOT, come from these individuals who oftentimes are retired people with lots of money and nothing better to do.
You know, you talk about the notion of imperialism, and growing up in America, all of us have heard of manifest destiny. That, of course, meant it was right that white European settlers had a God-given right to wipe out the culture and population that existed before the Europeans got here. And Manifest Destiny has been used to justify our many foreign adventures. What does Manifest Destiny have to do with your topic?
I think it's important to remember that Manifest Destiny isn't necessarily an American term. It isn't just a British term, but it dates all the way back through every empire. It was the belief that this particular empire, whether it was American or British or Japanese or Rome, had the right to dominate other countries, to expand its reach, to not just become richer through that expansion and more powerful, but it comes at the expense of colonialism. It comes at the expense of colonizing and subjugating those who do not agree with the way that that empire is encroaching and taking and usurping. Manifest Destiny with regard to cultural imperialism is a very fine point on mass incarceration that really encapsulates this idea of subjugation.
This call is from a North Carolina correctional facility.
You know, we can talk all day about immigration and how this is just an immigration issue when it's really not. Immigration as a word is really kind of the curtain, if you will, that Manifest Destiny hides behind. It is expansionism in the worst sense, that if we can incarcerate you in another country, if we can quote-unquote deport you through transportation to other countries, if we can repatriate you to other countries, then we can not just outsource our problems, not just create private prisons and these other places that we profit from. We can slowly gain a toehold in these countries and get them to believe that, as we do, to align with us in such a way that they become assimilated. And through that assimilation, you see Manifest Destiny, or Manifest Destiny goes through that assimilation. It's kind of a mutual relationship.
So they become,
and the carceral system is a way for that assimilation to occur.
So they become these other countries, kind of a partner, an auxiliary to the powerful nation exerting its strength and being imperial against people that they want to control, if not totally erase. Now, before Trump 2.0, you assert that, quote, it seemed that we were making progress toward better understanding of how race, gender, and class shape American life. But you say, quote, the last election tells the story of a country that is resisting the necessary exorcism of its wrongdoing, much like Germany after the Holocaust. In effect, evolving standards of decency simply exposed the big lie behind our country, that we are a society interested in liberty and justice for all, end of quote. Wow, that is a powerful statement. And what makes you accept the accuracy of that?
If we are to look at what happened with the Holocaust and what happened after the Holocaust, not just the removal of the Nazi Party, not just the trials and the efforts to really kind of atone for what was done to the Jewish people and so many millions of others. It was the basic understanding that there was something wrong that happened with the Holocaust, that there was an acknowledgement of that. That is not occurring in this country.
Yeah, that's for sure.
Not only is it not occurring in this country, there's the belief that it is justified what is being done to people seeking a better life from other countries. They're justifying it through that criminalization process. And how that exposes a lie is if we are to look into the criminal justice system itself, into the way the criminal legal system unfolds as a process, if you begin with something as simple as a charge and go to trial and say that charge is wrong from the beginning, but it doesn't matter because this is an adversarial process. And in that adversarial process, if you are criminally convicted by a jury, that jury verdict is upheld as sacrosanct. It doesn't matter how wrong it is. It doesn't matter whether the information that jury received was partial or wrong or misinformed or disinformed. All that matters is that it occurred. And then once you are criminally convicted,
that's it.
And the finality of that verdict is upheld through quote unquote due process, you can get all the way to the highest court in the land. And those justices, in particular, the conservative justice will say, you know what? You had a trial. And the jury returned a verdict. And that's all that really matters in our system. That's not justice.
No.
That was never justice. And if that's what we borrow from to say, okay, we're upholding law and order, then that's not law and order either. That's just might and right.
Might and right. And, you know, this mass incarceration, the carceral imperialism, is not brand new. We're just becoming more aware of it now through the incredibly not subtle exercises of the Trump regime and Homan and the ICE. It's making it just something we can't avoid, but we've been avoiding dealing with the terribly, terribly broken system of justice, system of injustice, for a long time. So about that, and it's part of carceral imperialism. Please tell us what you call evidence-based corrections and what gives you reason to think that we're becoming more aware that, as you write, punitive, dehumanizing approaches to crime have proven to be ineffective.
This call is from a North Carolina correctional facility.
Understanding evidence-based corrections is understanding that the people who run prisons, who are actually interested in reducing crime and making sure that punishment on some level is effective, know that there are certain things about that process that have to happen. One of those things, outside of the general idea of punishment, is rehabilitation.
Yes.
And rehabilitation means not just psychological development and mental health, it's formal education, it's substance abuse treatment, it's an effort to atone for the crimes that were committed against victims. And all of these things together create what are called evidence-based corrections.
Uh-huh.
And the evidence comes from sociological studies that are done on various groups and different forms of policies that are applied within the prison system. A real basic example is the use of solitary confinement. When we talk about solitary confinement, and we're talking about 23 or more hours a day in confinement, in a cell, without communication, in isolation, after a certain period of time, it becomes a form of psychological torture and torment.
Yes.
It is not effective at curbing violent behavior or behavior that stems from mental health issues. This has been acknowledged by the international community. It is why they have passed what's called the Mandela Rule, which states that anything over 2 weeks in solitary confinement is a form of torture.
Oh, yeah.
Well, evidence-based corrections is going to align with what we know to be facts-based, is going to divest itself, is going to cut off any kind of idea that what is done in prisons is an element of that crime narrative, is an element of being tough. Being
yes.
tough doesn't always mean being effective. And in order to reduce crime and reintegrate people from prisons back into society, that means doing what works, not opposed, not what is punitive or draconian or inhumane.
Yeah, it is inhumane, and we keep on doing it. As an amateur historian, I long ago came to the conclusion that despite being taught in school that history moves in a straight line, ever forward, progress all the time, the truth is history actually moves in many directions at the same time. This unique moment in American history contains obviously, formerly unthinkably awful components, but you say it also contains seeds for real changes. There are actually quite positive prospects. For example, you say there's an emerging new approach to our terribly failed and remarkably inhumane system of mass incarceration that, quote, maybe means mass incarceration has reached a significant turning point, one that recognizes our humanity and comes to the understanding that filling prisons with people in perpetual confinement is not the answer, unquote. Well, on June 14th this year, in particular, somewhere between 5 and 12 million Americans from all over the country filled the streets with protests against Trumpism, the various aspects of Trumpism. The focus of these protests was not really on our prison systems, but what gives you hope that large and growing movement may have something to say and do about mass incarceration? What makes you think that there is some, dare I say, progress happening at the same time as this awful stuff?
I think what I draw hope from, especially in reference to the No Kings protests,
yes,
is the idea that people are really beginning to feel this oppression. And I am sorry that they have to experience that in order to know that it's a bad thing. It gives me hope because in that experience is the knowledge and ability to do something before it's too late, before it becomes an actual circumstance where their vote no longer matters. Their vote still does matter. Their ability to remove these people from office who have and continue to do these terrible things to American citizens and people of other countries. I think it's critical that the youth of American society get involved in that, and I'm hopeful. Certainly with the nomination for in the Democratic primary of Zohran Mamdani, and of course in other states where we see other youth stepping into leadership roles and seeking to really kind of challenge this current narrative in such a way that it's not being done well enough by established Democrats in office. And that it really has to happen, certainly during the midterms, now while there's still a chance.
As FDR famously told A. Philip Randolph, head of the all-black Pullman Porters Union, "I'm with you. I want it to happen. Now go out and make me do it." And people, I think, on the streets are starting to feel energized and recognize that's the only way change happens, is when the elected politicians see that they need to do something about this. It's starting to happen. Well, this has been a fascinating discussion. Lyle May, thank you so much for being with us today.
We have 30 seconds remaining.
If people want to see your article, Carceral Imperialism, Project 25, and the Enemy of Progress, what can they go to? Something on the internet?
They can go to Prism News, or they can go to my website, lylecmay.com.
Thank you so much, and let's hope we learn something. Sometimes we learn. Rarely, but sometimes we do. Thank you so much, Lyle May.
Well, I just wanted to thank you and encourage people to do their research, certainly pay attention, and absolutely go out and vote because it matters. And if you feel like you want to do more than vote, then it helps to get involved in campaigns with people that you want to see in office, whether that means knocking on doors or raising funds or otherwise spreading the word online. And it's also important for people to kind of check those who seem to think it doesn't have anything to do with them. It absolutely does. If you live in this country, it has to do with you. There is no sideline. There is no medium ground. It's absolutely a war for our democracy.
Couldn't agree more. Thank you so much for being with us. And good luck with everything. And the people, they want us to believe we're powerless. We are not powerless. Thank you.
I just wanted to thank you and encourage people to do their research, certainly pay attention, and absolutely go out and vote because it matters. And if you feel like you want to do more than vote, then it helps to get involved in campaigns with people that you want to see in office, whether that means knocking on doors or raising funds or otherwise spreading the word online. And it's also important for people to kind of check those who seem to think it doesn't have anything to do with them. It absolutely does. If you live in this country, it has to do with you. There is no sideline. There is no medium ground. It's absolutely a war for our democracy.
Couldn't agree more. Thank you so much for being with us. And good luck with everything. And they want us to believe we're powerless. We are not powerless. Thank you. If you enjoyed that discussion, don't miss a single show. Subscribe. It's all free. And if you find the information valuable, your friends probably do too. Ask them to also subscribe. It's on Apple, Spotify, Substack, Progressive Radio Network, Stitcher, iHeartRadio, and of course, the website, keepingdemocracyalive.com. Thanks very much.
You are tuned in to KBOO Portland, 90.7 on your FM dial.
I'm Doug McVeigh, host of Free Culture Radio. Every month, we bring you 30 minutes of news and information about people who use drugs as we discuss